No one can tell for sure who first wrote the Serenity Prayer. Some say it came from the early Greeks. Others think it was from the pen of an anonymous English poet. Still others claim it was written by an American naval officer. And Jack Alexander, who once researched the matter, attributes it to the Reverend Reinhold Niebuhr of the Union Theological Seminary. Anyhow, we have the prayer, and it is said thousands of times daily. We count its writer among our great benefactors. Our phenomenal expansion soon brought us face to face with a very important problem of public relations. The national spotlight was now on us. We had to begin dealing with the public on a large scale. Public ill will could stunt our growth or even bring it to a standstill. Public confidence could swell our ranks to numbers of which we had only dreamed before. The Saturday Evening Post piece had proved this. Public relations was not only a big problem, but a very delicate one. Any blunders that could arouse general prejudice might prolong the suffering of many and cost. A carefully thought out public relations policy had to be formed and put into operation. Prime consideration was given to our relations with medicine and religion. Under no circumstances must we get into competition with either. If we appeared to be a new religious sect, we would certainly be in trouble. And if we moved into the medical field as such, there would be more trouble. So we began to emphasize the fact that AA was a way of life that conflicted with no one's religious belief. We let the doctors know how much we needed hospitalization, and we suggested to psychiatrists and drying out places the advantage of cooperating with us. At all times, religion would be the province of the individual and of the clergyman, and the practice of medicine would be for our friends, the doctors. As alcoholic laymen, we were simply supplying the much-needed and long-lost missing link. These public relations attitudes have been maintained over the years since, and they have brought heartwarming results. Today, we have the unqualified support of nearly every religious denomination. Most medical practitioners who understand AA send their alcoholic patients to us. Our members speak frequently before religious gatherings and medical societies, and the men of medicine and religion are often seen at AA's open meetings. But medicine and religion, important as they are, prove to be only a fraction of our total public relations problem. We also had to determine how best to cooperate with the press, radio, motion pictures, and more recently, television. How to deal with employers who wanted special help. What would be the right attitude toward the field of alcohol education, research, and rehabilitation, private and public? What would we say to prisons and hospitals who wanted AA groups within their walls? What were we to tell AAs who went into some of these fields and who were then tempted to capitalize publicly upon the AA name for advertising or fundraising? What would we say or do if AA were ever widely exploited, defamed, or attacked by outsiders? Workable solutions to all these and many more such problems had to be found, or AA might suffer serious consequences. Finding answers to these public relations puzzlers has been a long process. After much trial and error, sometimes punctuated by painful mistakes, the attitudes and practices that would work best for us emerged. The basic ones can be seen today in the AA traditions. 100% anonymity at the public level. No use of the AA name for the benefit of other causes, however worthy. No endorsements or alliances. The carrying of the message as the single purpose for Alcoholics Anonymous. No professionalism. Public relations by the principle of attraction rather than promotion. These were some of the hard-learned lessons. It was natural that our Board of Trustees and the headquarters office became the focal point around which the AA traditions were formed. Problems of every description poured in upon us. But by 1945, a considerable degree of order had come out of what had been a chaotic situation. On all sides, the membership of our society asks for the experience and guidance of the New York office in solving their problems. Things finally began to run so smoothly that the average AA member has taken our world service record for granted. Until recently, these headquarters services were largely invisible to him. Nevertheless, this unseen activity has surely been responsible for much of our growth and unity. Over the years, the functioning of the foundation, the wide use of the AA book, the expansion of pamphlet literature, the answering of thousands of pleas for help, the response to requests for guidance on group problems, the working out of our relations with the public, all these constituted a growing service to the whole world of AA. At long last, our society really had begun to function as a whole. The 1941 to 1945 period brought still other developments. Our downtown Vesey Street office was moved to 415 Lexington Avenue, just opposite Grand Central Station. We made this move because the need for serving the many AA travelers through New York had become urgent. Our new location near Grand Central brought us into contact with visitors who, for the first time, began to see Alcoholics Anonymous as a vision for the whole world. Thousands of AAs, their families, their friends, their clergymen, their doctors, and their employers have since visited the New York headquarters. The growth of Alcoholics Anonymous continued at a pace which was to us sometimes staggering. By almost geometrical progression, the multiplication went on year after year. We no longer counted by thousands. We began to reckon by tens of thousands. But this was not the whole story. For the first time, we had begun to sense that the character of AA was changing. We were beginning to have success with milder alcoholics, and even some potential alcoholics. In the first years, those of us who sobered up in AA had been grim and utterly hopeless cases, almost without exception. But now, younger folks began to appear. Lots of people turned up who still had jobs and homes and health and even good social standing. These, in their turn, were able to persuade others like themselves of the need for AA. Of course, it was necessary for these types of newcomers to hit bottom emotionally. But we found they did not have to hit every possible bottom there was in order to admit that they were licked. We began to develop a conscious technique of raising the bottom and hitting them with it. When one of these mild cases arrived at the conviction that he already had the principal symptoms of alcoholism, that was usually enough. He hit bottom then and there, and so was spared years of anguish. In something of the same fashion, this idea began to work out with other kinds of prospects. In the beginning, we could not sober up women. They were different, they said. But when they saw other women get well, they slowly followed suit. The derelict, the rich man, the socialite, all these once thought AA was not for them. So did certain people of other races and tongues and creeds. But when they clearly saw the alcoholic tragedy for which they were headed, they could forget their differences and join AA. As these new trends came into full view, we were overjoyed. Today, more than half of AA's membership consists of mild cases and those who once thought they were different. Then the spread to foreign lands began. This development brought us a whole new set of problems to solve. Each new distant beachhead had to go through its flying blind and pioneering period, just as we had in the United States. Soon we were running into language barriers, and more of our pamphlet literature had to be translated into other tongues. In addition, our foreign friends raised new and special doubts. Maybe AA was just a Yankee gadget that would be no good for Ireland, England, Holland, Scandinavia, Australia, and the Pacific. Since their countries were so different, maybe their alcoholics were different too. Will AA work in our cultures? They asked. We became heavily involved in correspondence, much helped by our American members in New York who could translate for us. We searched out and briefed AA travelers going abroad. Gradually, headway was made. It was a long time, however, before we knew for sure that AA could cross the barriers of distance, race, creed, and language. But today, the AA map shows our society in more than 70 countries and U.S. possessions. We now feel sure that it is only a question of time until every alcoholic in the world may well have as good a chance to recover as we have had here in America. Serving the foreign groups has become a major headquarters activity, although we have scarcely scratched the total possibilities so far. Good translations of AA literature are ever more urgently needed, but able helpers have always turned up to meet that need. Some 10 years ago, Frank M. translated the AA book into Spanish. He worked daytimes as interpreter for a New York importer, and at night, he labored over his love, the book Alcoholics Anonymous. Today, his translation is the foundation cornerstone for AA in Spanish-speaking countries. Somewhat later, certain Quebec members did an equally fine piece of work, this time in French. At Oslo, we hope our big book will soon be published in Norwegian. Because of the language similarity, the Danes and the Swedes will also be able to read our basic text when it appears in Norwegian. Many of our pamphlets have already been published in still other tongues, notably German, Dutch, and Finnish. We strive constantly to cross more language barriers, thus throwing new lifelines to those who don't yet know that there is a way out. Since AA was growing so fast, headquarters had to grow too. Thousands of group contributions and our increasing literature sales soon demanded a full-time bookkeeper. Getting out our directory of AA groups began to be a job rather like publishing a suburban telephone book. Letter and Cardex files began to appear in rows. More alcoholic staff members had to be engaged. As the work was divided among them, departments began to be created. Today's office is departmentalized to cover the following activities: group relations, domestic and foreign, public relations, general service conference, office management, mailing, packing, accounting, stenographic, and special service to prison and hospital groups. Fortunately, the office did not have to grow as fast as AA did. The bill would never have been paid if it had. AA was getting so big that we could not possibly educate all members on what headquarters was doing. Many groups, preoccupied with their own affairs, failed to help us at all. Less than half of them contributed anything. We were plagued by constant deficits in contributions, which luckily could be plugged up with money from the sale of the big book and our growing pamphlet literature. Without this book income, we would have folded up entirely. The year 1944 brought a vital development. In New York City, a few literary and news-minded AAs began to issue a monthly publication. This original group consisted of Marty, Priscilla, Lois K., Abbott, Maeve, and Kay. Besides these, Grace O. and her husband turned up among its moving spirits. They called their magazine The Grapevine. It was by no means the first local AA bulletin or magazine. The Cleveland Central Bulletin, the Los Angeles Eye Opener, and several others had preceded it, but The Grapevine caught on nationally. After the first few months, it encountered a strange kind of difficulty. It turned out that the FBI, for a long time, had published a sheet called The Grapevine. It was largely devoted to keeping FBI men up to date on the doings of their great service. Things were finally ironed out when we began to call our monthly magazine the AA Grapevine. With this minor difficulty overcome, our grapevine grew and grew. The circulation has since risen to more than 40,000 copies a month. A footnote here says, as of 1957, office procedures described here also have changed. The Grapevine is the mirror of AA thought and action worldwide. It is a sort of magic carpet on which all of us can travel from one distant AA outpost to another, and thus it has become a wonderful exchange medium of our current thought and experience. After a while, the grapeviners discovered that they had a bear by the tail. It was always fun to get in the material and edit the pieces, but licking all those postage stamps and mailing thousands of copies finally became an impossible job. So they asked that the foundation take over. When the trustees inquired of the AA groups if they would like to make the Grapevine their international magazine, their answer was yes. The journal was incorporated, and two foundation trustees were seated on its board of directors, along with the editors. The Grapevine had to have full-time help. This created a mounting deficit, and again, funds from the big book had to come to the rescue. Without this aid, the magazine would have suspended publication. Even more than the headquarters office, the AA Grapevine can always use a large staff of volunteers. Only the managing editor, her assistants, the head of the subscription department, and a few routine workers are on the payroll. The editor, the editorial board, the artists, and many writers always do a vast amount of volunteer work on every issue. Without such expert volunteers, we could have no magazine at all. Were we to pay them for their services, the bill would be prohibitive. How these busy professional men and women are able to meet the Grapevine deadline every month will always be a mystery to the rest of us. It is one of the most consistent and brilliant volunteer efforts that AA has seen. Even as early as 1945, the solution of group problems by correspondence had put a large volume of work on headquarters. Letters to Metropolitan AA centers filled our bulging files. It seemed as if every contestant in every group argument wrote us during this confused and exciting period. The basic ideas for the 12 traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous came directly out of this vast correspondence. In late 1945, a good AA friend suggested that all this mass of experience might be codified into a set of principles which could offer tested solutions to all our problems of living and working together and of relating our society to the world outside. If we had become sure enough of where we really stood on such matters as membership, group autonomy, singleness of purpose, non-endorsement of other enterprises, professionalism, public controversy, and anonymity in its several aspects, then such a set of principles could be written. A code of traditions could not, of course, ever become rule or law, but it might act as a guide for our trustees, headquarters people, and especially for AA groups with growing pains. Being at the center of things, we of headquarters would have to do the job. Aided by my helpers there, I set to work. The Traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous were first published in the so-called long form in the Grapevine of May 1946. Additional Grapevine pieces then explained the traditions in detail. These continued to appear for several months. Later on, these articles were incorporated in a pamphlet called AA Tradition. All of our headquarters staff members and many group secretaries still rely on well-thumbed and battered copies of this first tradition pamphlet for their guidance in times of trouble. At the foundation, meanwhile, we had taken a significant action that was incorporated in these traditions. In 1945, we wrote Mr. John D. Rockefeller, Jr. and the 1940 dinner guests that we would no longer need their financial help. The book royalties could now look after Dr. Bob and me. Group contributions could pay the general office expenses. If these were insufficient, the reserve accumulated out of literature sales could meet the deficit. This meant that we had finally declared for full self-support. Since that time, AA's Board of Trustees has steadfastly refused outside contributions. When first published, the traditions got a mixed reception. Only groups in dire trouble took them seriously. But in some quarters, there was a violent reaction against them, especially in groups that had long lists of protective rules and regulations. At the other extreme, there was much apathetic indifference. Still others said, let's keep AA simple. To them, the 12 traditions seemed only a needless expression of the hopes and fears of General Headquarters for AA's future. At this point, I began to travel and talk a lot about the new principles. The members listened, but were obviously bored. After a while, I received letters like this. "Bill, we would love to have you come and speak. Tell us where you used to hide your bottles, and tell us about that hot flash spiritual experience of yours. But please don't talk any more about those damn traditions." Time has changed all that. Several years later, it was recognized that the 12 traditions were going to be just as necessary to the life of our society as the 12 steps were to the life of each member. We saw that the AA traditions were the key to the unity, the functioning, and even the survival of Alcoholics Anonymous. In reality, I had not been the author of the traditions at all. I had merely put them on paper in such a way as to mirror principles which had already been developed in AA group experience. AA's General Headquarters, its trustees, and its staff had actually made the formulation of these vital principles possible. Had there been no headquarters to bring our group problems into focus, the 12 traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous could never have been written. By this time, AA had begun to find favor in the world of medicine. Two of America's great medical associations took unprecedented steps in recognizing us. In 1944, the Medical Society of the State of New York had invited me to read a paper at its annual meeting. After the reading, three of the physicians present, Dr. Harry Thibault, Dr. Kirby Collier, and Dr. Foster Kennedy, stood up and gave AA the firmest kind of endorsement. The society itself went still farther. It published the paper in its journal and permitted AA to make reprints. Large numbers of this pamphlet have since been distributed all over the world, carrying the assurance to doctors everywhere that AA is medically sound. In 1949, the American Psychiatric Association did exactly the same thing. I read a paper at its annual meeting in Montreal. This was a still more exacting assignment, and I frankly wondered what I should say. I wound up by describing the spiritual experience as we understand it in AA. As I read, I doubted if even a handful of the audience could possibly agree with the views expressed in my paper. To my astonishment, there was a sustained round of applause. But this was not at all a tribute to me or to the contents of my paper. It was instead a tribute to Alcoholics Anonymous, a tribute to a way of life which had worked for alcoholics when other approaches had failed. This generous response was evidence that our friends as psychiatrists were being much more tolerant of us than we had been of them. If we ourselves became more open-minded, then far greater cooperation with this profession would be assured. The association promptly confirmed the view of its members in Montreal. My paper was carried in the American Journal of Psychiatry, and we were permitted to reprint it in a pamphlet now entitled Alcoholism, the Illness. There's a footnote here which says, later retitled Three Talks to Medical Societies by Bill W., this pamphlet also includes Bill's paper before the Medical Society of the State of New York. Our standing with the psychiatric profession has increased greatly since that time. State and county medical associations began to ask AA members to make appearances before them. All these medical papers have served our foreign groups especially well, saving them the years that were once required here in America to demonstrate AA's worth to physicians. The medical aspect of alcoholism includes the problem of hospitalization. And here also great progress has been made. Many hospitals have been reluctant to take alcoholics at all. State and provincial institutions usually have required alcoholics to stay for long periods of commitment. Therefore, it has been difficult, and it still is, to persuade the average general hospital to take in AA prospects for short periods of treatment and to grant sponsors the necessary visiting privileges in cooperation with our local intergroup associations. It is good to report that this condition is rapidly changing for the better. Our pioneering activity in this field, together with the use which AA Headquarters has been able to make of that experience, has a special interest for us all. Two American hospitals have afforded fine examples of how medicine and AA can best cooperate. At St. Thomas Hospital in Akron, Dr. Bob, the wonderful Sister Ignatia, and the hospital staff presided over an alcoholic ward which had treated several thousand alcoholics by the time of Dr. Bob's death in 1950. And beginning in 1945, Knickerbocker Hospital in New York provided an AA ward under the care of our first friend in medicine, Dr. William D. Silkworth, who was assisted with rare devotion and skill by Nurse Teddy. By 1954, 10,000 alcoholics had been referred to Knickerbocker by the New York Intergroup Association and had passed through this ward, the majority on their way to freedom. Since proper hospitalization is one of AA's greatest problems, the New York headquarters continues to pass on the knowledge gained from this early experience, along with its many subsequent developments and ramifications, to AA groups all over the world. Meanwhile, a great tide of public approval, stimulated by AA's friends of press, radio, and in recent times television, began to sweep in upon us, and it has never ceased. Each month, a clipping service feeds our headquarters scrapbooks with a very large amount of material. Writers constantly ask headquarters to check their manuscripts. AA members are helped to appear anonymously on radio and TV programs. The making of arrangements for publicity has become a constantly increasing activity of our AA office. How many lives have been saved? How many years of misery have thus been averted for thousands of alcoholics and their families? Only God knows. To maintain these ever-lengthening lifelines of service, our office had to go on expanding. In 1950, we moved to 141 East 44th Street, still closer to Grand Central. Today, this office is presided over by Chairman Hank on part-time and six fine staff secretaries. These paid staff members are greatly helped by volunteer committee men who are experts in law, finance, and public relations. On the routine service staff, about 12 non-alcoholics look after bookkeeping, filing, and stenography, and two receptionists preside over the outer office. There, visitors see the walls covered with sectional maps showing the worldwide reach of our fellowship. On a table stands a winged victory, symbol of the Lasker Award given to AA by the American Public Health Association in 1951. The editorial offices of the Grapevine are on the floor below. Here, Editor Don and his volunteer assistants confer with the managing editor and her assistant to meet the monthly deadline. Farther downtown, where rents are cheaper, there is a large floor space where the circulation department looks after the Grapevine's 40,000 readers and their needs. Three blocks away from the main office, we have a good-sized loft space where all shipping and mailing is done. This activity now runs into tons of material a month. Six busy lads spend full time at it. Last year, they shipped about 40,000 books and hundreds of thousands of pamphlets, many of them newly designed and edited, largely through the work of Ralph, our consultant on pamphlet literature. They mailed about 30,000 letters and bulletins and did huge quantities of mimeographing. Down one side of the long packing room, on shelves reaching to the ceiling, are scores of boxed-up files. These are the old records of our headquarters, going clear back to the days at Vesey Street. The world story of AA is hidden in these boxes, waiting only to be searched out, and we have just begun the job. In a partitioned off-corner office near the files, our research librarian is digging into the history of Alcoholics Anonymous. In addition to the present brief sketch, I hope that someday the full-length history of Alcoholics Anonymous will be written. Because of this research activity, it is now certain that the basic facts of AA's growth and development never can become distorted. Such is one of our newest undertakings. No description of AA's world services would be complete without acknowledgement of all that has been contributed by our non-alcoholic trustees. Over the years, they have given a great amount of time and effort. Theirs has been the wisdom that has caused our affairs to make financial sense. And frequently, in times of heated debate, they have headed off the rash decisions that we volatile alcoholics would surely have made. Some of them, like Mr. Jack Alexander, Mr. Fulton Ousler, Mr. Leonard V. Harrison, and Mr. Bernard B. Smith, have given much to us out of their special fields of literature, social service, finance, and law. Their example is being followed by more recent trustees, such as Mr. Frank Golden, Dr. John Norris, Mr. Archibald Roosevelt, and Mr. Ivan Underwood. The very special contributions of my brother-in-law, Dr. Leonard V. Strong, Jr., Mr. Willard Richardson, Mr. A. Leroy Chipman, and Mr. Frank B. Amos have already been described. And a little farther on, we shall consider at some length the vital role that Mr. Leonard Harrison played as longtime chairman of the foundation during the uncertain period of our adolescence. That period, 1945 to 1950, was one of immense strain and test. We were confronted by three grave issues. The first had to do with money, the second with anonymity, and most dangerous of all, there was the question of what was to become of Alcoholics Anonymous when its old-timers and founders had gone. In 1945, we had begun to decline outside contributions, but another similar hazard soon presented itself. Wealthy people, some of them AA members, began to insert large bequests in their wills with the direction that these funds be given to the Alcoholic Foundation in trust for Alcoholics Anonymous. One of these bequests became available during a period when AA's headquarters was in severe financial straits. At one point, group contributions to the office failed to meet the bill by $2,000 a month, and the grapevine deficits were almost half that amount. The question was then asked, even if we cannot take money from living contributors, what reason is there for not accepting it from deceased ones? But after long debate and soul-searching, the trustees finally turned all these bequests away, thereby consolidating and cementing the AA tradition of self-support for all time to come. To thoughtful AAs everywhere, this action of the trustees brought a deep new feeling of relief and security. A real peril had been averted. The intense drive that most of us alcoholics have for money, prestige, and power then crashed into the open by way of broken anonymity at the public level. This development of the 1945-1950 period was made even more dangerous by the fact that most of the anonymity breakers meant well. Having done some anonymity breaking at an earlier period myself, I could well appreciate their good intentions. Sometimes these folks wanted to use the AA name publicly in order to help other good causes. Sometimes they just wanted their names and pictures in the papers, always, of course, to help AA. They actually believed that being photographed with a governor would really help. Finally, we saw that the risk to AA would be appalling if all our power drivers finally got loose at the public level. Scores of them were already doing it. So AA headquarters got to work. We wrote remonstrances, kind ones, of course, to every breaker. We sent letters to nearly all press, radio, and publishing outlets explaining why AAs should not break their anonymity before the general public. Group feeling, combined with the headquarters' efforts, finally squeezed the anonymity breakers down to a mere handful within a few years. Had this tendency not been checked, the whole character of our society could have changed, and its future could have been fearfully compromised. In 1947, Dr. Bob had been stricken by an ailment that we all knew might prove fatal. At headquarters, this gave us plenty to think about. The main link between our World Services and AA itself had been Dr. Bob, our secretarial staff, and me. To our worldwide fellowship, its devoted Board of Trustees was scarcely known at all. Not one AA in 1,000 could name even half of them. When death or disability finally took us few old-timers out of the picture, where would that leave the trustees and the headquarters? A single blunder on their part might cause a failure of confidence that could not be repaired. Lacking the moral and financial support of the groups, the whole headquarters effort might collapse completely. Our services might never be reinstated because nobody could be authorized to do the job. It was evident that here was a worldwide movement that had no direct access to its own principal service affairs. The trustees had authority over our services. AA itself had no authority. The simple trusteeship had been the ideal guardian for our infancy and adolescence, but how in future years could it possibly go on functioning as it had? This situation had been a matter of great concern to me ever since the publication of the Traditions in 1946. I had sent the trustees many memorandums on the subject. There had been considerable discussion. At first, we had talked vaguely about a hand-picked advisory council or an elected conference of some sort. But since there was no imminent danger, no action was taken. When Dr. Bob became ill, I began to feel the serious urgency of the problem. So did Mr. Bernard Smith and one or two of the others. But the majority of the board did not share our apprehension. They felt that creating a conference, or even an advisory council, would entail unnecessary politics and expense. The foundation had done well for 10 years, so why could it not go on in just the same way? Typically alcoholic, I became very excited, and this turned the passive resistance of my fellow workers into solid opposition. A serious rift developed between me and the alcoholic members of the board, and as the months went by, the situation became worse and worse. With much reason, they resented my sledgehammer tactics and my continued violence. As the tempest increased, so did my blistering memorandums to the board. One of them was an amazing composition. Following a long plea for an elected AA conference and other reforms, and after having pointed out that the trustees had all the authority there was, with no responsibility to anyone, even to Dr. Bob and me, I finished the memo with this astonishing sentence. When I was in law school, the largest book I studied was the one on trusts. I must say, gentlemen, that it was mostly a long and melancholy account of the malfeasances and misfeasances of boards of trustees. I had written this to a group of the best friends I had in the world, people who had devoted themselves to AA and to me without stint. Obviously, I was on a dry bender of the worst possible sort. This sizzling memorandum nearly blew the foundation apart. Our non-alcoholic friends were dumbfounded. My alcoholic colleagues among the opposition trustees darkly murmured that I must have gone crazy. They felt sure of it when I set out on the road in 1948 to sound out among the groups the possibility of an elected conference to which the Board of Trustees could eventually become accountable. Soon after I left on my travels, the alcoholic trustees got a hold of old-timers in Akron, New York, and Cleveland to decide in conclave what could be done about the situation, and especially about me. They supposed that out on the road I was widely airing the dispute and looking for backing. Happily, I refrained from doing this, and the conclave of old-timers exercised some restraint, too. They merely advised the board that things were all right as they were, that no elected conference or advisory council was necessary, and that there was no need for any of the internal changes that I had suggested. But although I had not generally raised the issue among the groups, I did come back with the conviction that they would like to have full access to their own affairs through an elected conference. Of this much I was now certain. By 1949, Dr. Bob was definitely failing. At the office, Bobby, caught squarely in the middle of this fracas about the conference, was already exhausted to the cracking point. This was the low ebb. Then, slowly, the tide began to turn. Had it not been for our non-alcoholic friends on the board, I doubt if the impasse could ever have been resolved. As we entered 1950, this conflict had been going on almost 5 years. The two men who ultimately saved the situation were Mr. Leonard Harrison and Mr. Bernard Smith. Though Mr. Harrison did not then see the necessity for the elected conference, his unfailing tact and good sense, together with the respect and affection he had engendered among us all, were the qualities that kept our shaky foundation on its course. Most of the non-alcoholics on the board at the time had been institutional men. Bernard Smith, on the other hand, was a businessman and lawyer. From the time he had joined the board 3 years earlier, he had always favored corporate management for the AA office and an elected conference to sit with the trustees as the final plan of service structure for Alcoholics Anonymous. At this critical juncture, Mr. Harrison appointed Bernard Smith as chairman of the trustees' committee on the proposed conference. Considering their differences of opinion, this was a most magnanimous and generous act on Leonard's part. The recollection of it never fails to inspire me. Bernard Smith has a remarkable faculty for persuasion and negotiation. Moreover, his ideas about a conference had already taken a deeper hold than any of us realized. After the air had cleared somewhat, he took up the task of convincing the trustees' committee on the conference. Following only two meetings, he put this question to the committee: shall we set up this conference of delegates, or shall we forget about it? To my astonishment, the committee unanimously said, "Let's give the conference a try." It seemed like a miracle. Just before this crucial decision, Alcoholics Anonymous had taken another step toward worldwide unity and function. In the summer of 1950, we held our first international convention in Cleveland, Ohio. About 3,000 were in attendance. The highlights of this occasion were Dr. Bob's last appearance and the confirmation of our 12 traditions by the convention as the permanent platform of unity and function on which our fellowship would henceforth stand. The 12 traditions had already been reduced from the old long form of 1946 to capsule statements, which in length matched our familiar 12 steps of recovery. This had been done at the wise suggestion of Earl T., founder of our Chicago group. One day in 1947, or thereabouts, he turned up at my home with this excellent idea. After a week of wrestling with the problem of cutting down the long form, we came up with a first draft which much resembled the 12 traditions as they are today. After several months more of consultation and refining, the final draft was ready. The grapevine commenced to carry the newly stated traditions in every issue, and thus the average AA member was made tradition conscious. By the time the Cleveland Convention met, the understanding and approval of the traditions had become general throughout our society. At the Cleveland Convention, we sensed that Dr. Bob was soon going to leave us, and that many another early AA would soon follow him. The old order was changing. In the future, we could no longer depend upon the authority and influence of our pioneering people for AA unity. Henceforth, we would have to rely upon spiritual principles as set forth in the 12 traditions. Several speakers presented the 12 traditions to the convention. I then summed them up and asked the convention for final approval. Today, one can still listen, by means of a recording, to the convention's unanimous voice of consent. It was a fine hour in that month of July 1950. Alcoholics Anonymous had passed its 15th milestone. Its second legacy of tradition was secure.